It's the 8th of November 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Now, this week's show is a special show. If you've ever listened to NPR in America, you'll know that every now and then they have a fundraising week where they ask for your money. But we don't want your money. We want you. This week, we want to encourage you, yes you, to get involved with The Pod Delusion yourself. We're looking to expand our pool of contributors, and this week we're going to tell you exactly what you have to do. So that all sounds like a burden, but really it's not so bad. This week we're going to play some of our favourite reports by some of our regular contributors too, to show you how easy it is. But that's not all, we've even got an incentive. A very kind anonymous donor has donated the ticket to next year's QED convention in Manchester, which we covered on last week's show, to The Pod Delusion, for us to do with it whatever we like. So we want to give it away to one of our listeners, or better still, to one of our new contributors. If you're inspired by this week's show and would like to contribute, we're going to give the ticket to our best new contributor who contributes by the end of the year. So that's quite cool, isn't it? So have a listen, feel inspired, and drop us a line via poddelusion.co.uk and help us make the show week in, week out. But now, before we begin, a message from our sponsor. This episode of The Pod Delusion is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Stay tuned to the show for details of how to get your 10% discount. Now, on to business. Let's start with something simple, the classic Pod Delusion monologue. This is a platform for our contributors to opine on a subject that they have knowledge about, or an opinion on, or ideally, both. We ask contributors to aim for between 5 and 8 minutes generally, and it's simply a case of writing, recording and sending it in. It's dead easy to do. All you need is something to record your voice, like, say, an iPhone, which has a surprisingly good microphone in it, and then you can simply send us the file and we'll put it in the show. So here's a great example. Our first piece this week is from Sean Ellis. Sean has been contributing to the show for a few years now and has even spoken at a number of live events we've put on around the country. This piece marks the 50th anniversary of the LED, and in this piece, Sean tells us why they're so special.
If you look at any film which wants to give you the impression of high-tech gadgetry, you're bound to see the twinkle of little primary coloured LEDs. But LEDs aren't that up-to-date anymore. They're now officially over 50 years old. That's even older than me, which was surprising, so I did a little digging into their history, aided by the various 50 years of the LED articles scattered around the web. Tantalising glimpses of coloured light emission from ancient cat's whisker rectifiers have been documented as early as 1907, but there seemed no reliable way of duplicating the phenomenon, and it kind of languished for many years. But as the semiconductor revolution gathered pace in the post-war years, the understanding of how these amazing materials work deepened. In a semiconductor diode, a device which only allows current to flow one way, currents carried by both electrons and holes, which are the kind of the absence of electrons, and when these combine they lose energy as heat. It soon became clear that it might be possible to tune the energy of this process, and under the right conditions the electron-hole recombination could be made to emit light. This led to William Shockley, the inventor of the transistor, and two colleagues, Howard Briggs and James Haynes, to apply for patents on infrared light emitters in 1951, and they demonstrated it in supercooled silicon. The search was on for a material with the right property to actually make this a commercial prospect. Over a decade later, in 1962, Gunther Fenner at General Electric created an infrared laser diode using gallium arsenide, which was a novel material at the time. This inspired Dr. Nick Holoniak, who for other reasons was working with the even more exotic material gallium arsenide phosphide, to investigate its light-emitting properties. According to his calculations, the electrons and holes were at just the right energy to emit light in the red region of the spectrum, but it took him until October 1962 to fabricate a light-emitting device. This was, officially, the world's first LED. Holoniak's research assistant, George Crayford, furthered the work by introducing nitrogen impurities to fine-tune the energy and produced orange, yellow and green LEDs for the first time. The first LEDs were not terribly bright, but they were efficient, producing little heat, and they had excellent longevity. In fact, many LEDs made in the 1970s are still working today. The tiny computers on the Apollo missions, for example, use 7-segment LED displays. One of the reasons for this is because they're also very robust, being completely solid and typically encased in transparent resin. Compare that to the flimsy filament of an incandescent bulb suspended in a glass bubble of vacuum. Innovation flourished over the next couple of decades, producing even brighter and more efficient red, orange, yellow, and green varieties using even more exotic materials. Aluminium gallium arsenide for red, aluminium indium gallium phosphide for orange and green, but there was always something missing. Blue. The problem is that to get blue, you need a much higher energy than was available from any of the known materials, no matter how hard you tweak them. In 1990, silicon carbide was eventually persuaded to give off a dim aquamarine blue glow, and I have one of these early blue LEDs kicking around somewhere. You can't see it in daylight, and it costs 20 times as much as a comparable red LED. An interesting demonstration, but hardly practical. Calculations showed that nitrogen was, theoretically, the answer. As a replacement for phosphorus in the existing materials, it would boost the recombination energy into the right range for blue. But no one knew how to make nitrogen-based semiconductors that would form diodes. After many years, the Japanese researchers Masayuki Seno and Shuji Nakamura built the first gallium nitride blue LED in 1991. But it was Naruhito Isawa who invented a process suitable for mass production later that year, and by 1993 had found ways to increase the brightness of the emission by over 100 times. Tweaking the energy up using impurities again gave violet and ultraviolet light, useful in their own right, but by tweaking the emission energy down, the intense blue-green colour we now see in traffic lights was achieved, and then a pure green version. For the first time, LEDs now had high brightness red, green and blue emission, which by mixing them together gives us any colour in the visible spectrum. This is exactly what you need for large TV displays, and the signboards at football stadiums are testament to this technology. It was also possible to use a separate phosphor to convert some of the short wavelength blue light to yellow. Mixing blue and yellow light in the right proportions gives white, and the first white LEDs arrive shortly thereafter. More improvements in efficiency and colour balance came very quickly, and prices dropped as volume production kicked in. Today's LEDs still work on the same basic principles as their half-century-old predecessors, but the diligent work of materials physicists has enhanced their brightness, efficiency, and colour range by many orders of magnitude. What's next for the LED? I'll predict even more efficiency. As I record this, I'm sitting in my home office, which is 100% lit by LEDs. In the next decade or two, they will likely replace most other forms of lighting, both commercial and domestic, with very few exceptions. Don't believe me? Try getting incandescent Christmas tree lights these days. This is Sean Ellis, basking in the warm glow of recombining electron hole pairs for the Pod Delusion.
So we've heard a monologue, but how about an interview? For an interviewer, they can be nerve-wracking, but they get much easier once you realise that all you have to do is think of some vaguely interesting questions, and then you can sit back and watch the clever person you're interviewing say interesting and clever things in response. We record interviews in a number of ways. Ideally, we like to meet up with the guest, but if that isn't possible, then Skype is a surprisingly reliable second best. Here's a fine example in Liz Luckendorf's interview earlier this year with Cory Doctorow, who is the sort of person who you can just sort of set off and he'll be utterly fascinating for hours. Needless to say, there's a longer cut of this on our website if you'd like to hear more. Now, Liz, as regular listeners know, is our deputy editor. Though she started off just like everyone else, emailing in and offering to contribute, we now live together. Admittedly, this isn't likely to happen to every contributor, not least because my house would get rather crowded. But anyway, she's produced loads of things for us since, and they're all excellent. And this interview with Cory Doctorow is particularly good. Here's Liz talking about the future of the internet.
Do you think we know how integral the internet's going to be to our lives and to the world, or is it going to be surprising from year to year how more and more we use it?
Well, like I've said before, I think science fiction writers who try to predict the future are like drug dealers who sample their own product. So I don't know that I'm prepared to make a prediction about that, except to say that in general, the future is a lot weirder than we think it is. You know, there's this old saw that the job of a science fiction writer is to examine the car and the movie and invent the drive-in and infer the sexual revolution. And, you know, that seemed like a really, I think it was Gardner Dozois who said it, and it seemed like a really choice quote. And then I realized one day that actually the major impact of the car and the movie wasn't the sexual revolution. It was the fact that to get laid, you needed a driver's license, which meant that for the first time, people started carrying photo ID. And basically, this is the origin of the database state is in the car and the movie. And that third order effect is so much weirder than the second order effect and so much more profound and so much more lasting. And the sexual revolution is over, right? And no one talks about the sexual revolution anymore, but we are still living through the repercussions of the database nation. And it's probably going to change society in ways that dwarf the sexual revolution, as profound as that was. So I think that when we think about where the future of the internet might be, we tend to get stuck, you know, imagining our horseless carriages, you know, just like today, only more so. Not genuinely different. Not in the sense that, you know, Brian Eno talks about in The Oblique Strategies, where he says, imagine being the first person to try not doing something that no one has ever thought of not doing before. You know, what does it mean to do an encyclopedia without an editorial board? What does it mean to do an operating system without a company? You know, apply that kind of thinking, that kind of networked thinking, to stuff like education, aviation, civil planning, war, you know, molecular biology, space travel. And then you start, and that's where you start to get into, oh, yeah, no, the internet might do things that are profound and weird and unimaginable.
In the sense about science lecture, you mentioned WIPO and several of the treaties. And in combination with things like SOPA, RIPA, C10, the Digital Economy Act, are these all kind of related to WIPO, or are they completely separate? Like, I'm wondering how the international and the UN treaties work in terms of WIPO.
What these treaties tend to do and what the laws tend to do is reinforce themselves. So the eldest one is probably the Berne Convention, which Victor Hugo is responsible for. And the Berne Convention guarantees copyright protection for works without what are called formalities. And formalities means things like registering a copyright. And that sounds like quite a good idea, but then you realize that what it means is that it's very hard to figure out who a copyrighted work belongs to. In the US, when copyright only accrued in the face of a registration, it meant that if there was anything you wanted to license, you could figure out who to license it from, because you had to register a work to get a copyright for it. And it was cumbersome and onerous, but it needn't be like that. I mean, we can register a new Tumblr with about 9 keystrokes. It should be, you know, just about as easy to register a new copyright. So the Berne Convention requires a 50-year term of copyright and copyright without any formality. And then the WIPO Copyright Treaty, the WIPO Phonograms and Performers Treaty, and the World Trade Organization's TRIPS vision, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property something-something, all require that signatories put in Berne. So in order to be a WIPO WCT signatory, you have to also have agreed to Berne. And now what we see in new international instruments like ACTA and like TPP, the EU-Canadian Free Trade Agreement, the EU-US Free Trade Agreement, the US-Australian Free Trade Agreement, the US-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the US Free Trade Agreements with the Andean Nations, and so on, and the US-Korea Free Trade Agreement especially, are what are sometimes called TRIPS Plus or WIPO Plus provisions that say, in order to sign up to the WCT or to sign up to ACTA, you have to agree to implement the WCT plus something, 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 plus more. And what that means is that if your national government, so these treaties are negotiated usually not by the legislature, but by the executive. So by the prime minister's office, by the president's office. And so if the US trade representative or the Canadian trade representative, or the EU trade representative signs you up to this, and then later on your legislative body, your elected body, not an appointed bureaucrat, but the elected body decides to repeal some component of the Berne Convention, by changing your relationship with the Berne Convention, you are yanked out of the WTO, you're yanked out of the WPPT, you're yanked out of the WCT, you're yanked out of ACTA, you're yanked out of the EUCD, you're yanked out, I mean, so all of these other treaties fall apart. And so what it means is that if there's something in one of those other treaties you want, like, you know, the free trade in soybeans, or, you know, the common currency on the in the EU, or some other element that you want, you have to be prepared to give all of that up to renegotiate any component of the deal. So the deal, it's like it's been sort of buried over and then bricked up and then cemented over and then had a manhole plate riveted on top of that. And then on top of that, they're just piling, you know, enormous slabs of marble and, you know, strontium 90 and plutonium and, you know, marmite. You just, you have to remove all of this stuff to change any element of any of it. It's a bit like some mad survivor's raft that's been lashed together with thousands of you know, string and belts and netting and whatever you had, and everything is sort of lashed together as many ways as you can so that nothing can be cut. So it has the effect of, as our relationship with copyright is changing more and more, as, you know, our apparatus for copying works becomes more and more sophisticated and widely available, our ability to reflect those changes in law grows less and less, becomes less and less available. And so this is like a catastrophe if you actually care about copyright law. You know, I make my living from the copyright industry. I want to have sensible copyright laws that regulate the industry that I'm part of. And those laws, our rules can't be updated because they've been kind of lashed to this, you know, late 20th century and in the Berne Convention, you know, late 19th century version of how people relate to copyrighted works. And though that tying together has been completely frozen and we can't ever untangle it, it's been snarled up in this horrible knot.
Has there been any country able to escape this? Like, I was just thinking of the recent act, but if it's that kind of an ensnarement, have there been any countries that have escaped that? Or is it basically, if you want free trade or more open trade, you have to agree to this?
So you really hit it when you said free trade, because this is tied into the WTO, and because if you want to buy or sell around the world, you generally have to be a WTO signatory. Yeah, it's kind of locked into the WTO. I mean, there are countries that are outside these agreements, but they're countries like Iran, you know? And so, yeah, the WTO sort of ties it all up. What's interesting about this is not who accedes to it in law, but who can be held to it. So, for example, China very famously doesn't adhere to most of international copyright norms. You know, the state is intimately related in a lot of copyright infringements. And even where it isn't personally directly responsible, it turns a blind eye to it. And in theory, like, the rest of the world could say to China, well, China, you know, because you allow for the unlimited reproduction of Happy Meal toys, you know, we're cutting you off. But the rest of the world depends on, you know, this kind of railgun loaded with shipping containers filled with electronics and Happy Meal toys to be fired out of the port of Guangzhou. Like, kind of, you know, there's one container every second on average 24 hours a day that goes from Guangzhou to LA. And so, you know, the rest of the world can't really afford to say to China, oh, you know, respect copyright or we won't trade with you anymore. So, you know, the idea that this would somehow usher in a kind of new oil, right? That was the saying when these treaties came into being, that intellectual property is the new oil, so that the West would acquire oil essentially in the form of designs and in the form of ideas and patents, and that the rest of the world would pay it for this oil, has been a complete failure. Instead, what's ended up happening is we've undermined the fabric of the internet. We've turned the creative industries from industries that were in the business of making art into industries that are in the business of making lawsuits. We've made it completely impossible to enforce any kind of sanctions against states that don't respect the West's copyrights or patents. And we've also dismantled all of our manufacturing apparatus, so there's no way we can wean ourselves off of Pacific Rim manufacturing, although 3D printing may take a shot at it, as will robotics. But, you know, that opens up its own can of worms, because as we covered in the Sense About Science lecture, you know, we can essentially use automation to remove labor costs from manufacturing so that it costs the same to make something wherever you are in the world. All that does is further unbalance wealth around the world so that the rich get massively richer and everyone else has no job to do and gets, you know, progressively poorer and there's nothing in the middle. And that's not a sustainable economy either.
One of the things you just touched on a moment ago was the idea of just massive amounts of lawsuits. You mentioned in the lecture that there wasn't much suing over things like DVDs, but now with Blu-rays, or the coming of Blu-rays as a massive popular thing, that they've built up a war chest. Is this basically to take people to court for copyright infringement?
Yeah. So to license the DVD keys, it was very cheap. You just had to sign up to a set of rules. And what that meant was that the licensing body never had much of a budget to sue people. So they really had to pick their battles, and they didn't do much of it. With Blu-ray, they really raised the cost. And when I talked to the people who were running the Blu-ray licensing stuff when I was involved in DRM standard setting, they candidly admitted that the purpose of this was to raise a litigation war chest so that if companies started to do what companies had done with DVD players, which is to make DVD players first that were easy to render region-free and then just region-free DVD players. You remember, at first it was like you bought a DVD player, usually like an off-brand DVD player, and then you would go on the internet, it would say like, you know, take your remote and press up, down, left, right, start, you know, A, B, A, B, and then your DVD player becomes region-free. And then eventually that was replaced with players where like the sales clerk would just tell you to do this. And then that was replaced with players that just were advertised as region free. And now you can buy players that are region free in the high street. With Blu-ray, they didn't want that to happen. They wanted to make sure that when little companies in the Pacific Rim just popped up making Blu-ray players that were not compliant with the region coding rules, that they could immediately, you know, hire private eyes, track down who ran those companies, bring actions in their country of origin, sue them into the ground, sue the high street vendors that carry the technology, sue the distributors that brought it into the country, basically put the fear of God into anyone thinking about making region free, and just make sure that region free never came in with Blu-ray, that compliance remained with Blu-ray, and that, you know, the longer that they're collecting license fees from companies that want to make Blu-ray players, the bigger that war chest gets. So they have a great big war chest to sue people with. And I think that's why we haven't seen region-free high street products from Blu-ray.
Maybe kind of slightly related, but with the launch of Xbox One, there's been kind of rumors that suggest that it's going to be potentially restrictive when it comes to used games. Is this kind of the same thing? They're just trying to lock down a format?
Well, so yeah, selling a game is not illegal, right? But if the device is locked so that you can only play a game that's used by unlocking it, and if unlocking the device is illegal, then you can effectively end the trade in used games. So it's effectively a form of private law, right? Normally the way copyright law is written is Parliament sits down and figures out what rights the public should have and which rights investors and creators should have. And they say things like, well, you know, investors and creators should have the right to sell their works and make sure people can't copy them, but they don't have the right to control backup. So they don't have the right to control rental, or they don't have the right to control sale after, you know, second sales, the sales after initial purchase or whatever, right? You know, people who sell you the DVD can't tell you how many people can be in your sitting room when you watch it, how big your family can be. Right. But then you go and you put a software lock on the player and you back it up with one of these license agreements. So you can only unlock the software lock legitimately by signing up to a license agreement that binds you to all kinds of conditions. And now you can say, OK, well, anyone implementing a video playback for the Xbox has to have a camera that works, that has some secure path to the device, and has to implement a head count algorithm that tries to do face recognition, count the number of people in the room, and not play if there's more than seven people in the room, right? And so that's a form of private law. Parliament never said you get the right to tell people how many people can be in the room. And in fact, what Parliament does say is that all the rights that aren't given to rights holders are reserved to the public. But by adding DRM, and it doesn't have to work very well, right? It only has to be, you know, a colorable claim of DRM. You can effectively stop anyone from making a product that extends the functionality beyond that which is in it. In the same way that, like, you know, imagine you had a fridge where the option was with a butter dish or without a butter dish. But it was the same fridge, and if you chose without a butter dish, the butter dish was screwed shut with a special screw with a special head. And then the state criminalized making screwdrivers that could open the butter dish. Right. Well, fridge manufacturers be crazy not to avail themselves of this because, you know, it's a simple way to kind of charge people for stuff that they could get otherwise for themselves for free. But it represents a form of private law. It creates butter dish right. And you know, if butter dish right is a good idea, let's have Parliament debate it. But let's not have it created through the back door. Let's not have this series of rights that are effectively rights to your private property. Right, rights about the devices that you own, created, that take some of your rights in your private property and give them to industry, and take them away from you. You know, let's have our rights in private property be only taken away after debate and the passage of laws and some transparency and very infrequently, if ever, and not wholesale. Through the addition of a rule that just says anytime you put something that looks like DRM in a device, all the rights that the person has to their private property are up for grabs.
You gave the Sense About Science lecture and you're obviously very clued in and you write lots of things on the internet and books and things. So what are you up to next?
Oh, well, so I'm doing a bunch more speaking. I'm in Hay this weekend at the How the Light Gets In Festival at Hay on Y. And then I'm in Winnipeg at the Canadian Library Association. And then I'm talking at Index on Censorship and the Stoke Newington Literary Festival. I've got a bunch of UK books out. So I'm doing a lot of kind of what you might call whoring around for that. I'm working on a novella for Neal Stephenson and Arizona State University's project, the Hieroglyph Project, which is meant to use real science to inspire in science fiction to inspire people to think about careers in science and the value that science can bring. And I'm writing a story about 3D printers on the moon that are landed by hobbyists and that print out lunar habitats. After that, I'm working on a prequel to my first novel, Down or Not in the Magic Kingdom, about the a moment of post-scarcity revolution, of the scarcity in the midst of post-scarcity when automation obviates all labor, but economics means that in the absence of the need for human labor, no one has any money. And so even though there's no longer any need for scarcity, there's also no ability to acquire goods. There's horrible scarcity in the midst of non-scarcity. So I'm going to be writing this novel, and it's mostly going to be about how in a crisis, people generally behave themselves very well, even though the story that we tell ourselves is about people behaving very badly. That, you know, Cormac McCarthy's The Road is a horrible libel on the human race, that when the lights go out, we won't start alternately eating and raping each other, but we'll, in fact, probably take good care of each other.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us. It was a pleasure.
Oh, not at all. Nice chatting.
And now a message from our sponsors. This episode of The Pod Delusion is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, as well as 24/7 support. It's a seamless e-commerce solution, meaning that your business can take money in minutes on a website that is scaled to look beautiful on any computer or device. You can start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Pod Delusion listener, you'll receive 10% off your first purchase by using the offer code DELUSION11. Head over to squarespace.com/poddelusion to find out more. So you might be wondering how the show works. Well, basically, it's pretty simple. We've got a mailing list of around 150 contributors now, and every week I'll send out an email asking for pitches for pieces, or requests for things that I think would be really good on the show. Then the members of the list will go away and produce segments and send them in, and then we'll include them in the show when we put it together on Thursday evenings. If you'd like to join the mailing list, just drop us a line. You can find out more on poddelusion.co.uk. Anyway, on to the next piece, and earlier this year, Drew Ray recorded a segment for us about a coincidental spate of transport accidents. Drew is an academic studying risk analysis, so he was able to use his specialism to put together this absolutely fascinating piece on how we should approach analysing events like this. After contributing to the Pod Delusion for a couple of years, Drew got so into audio that he even started his own amazing podcast, The Disaster Cast, which you can find links to on our website. But now here's Drew talking trains.
The past several weeks have seen a number of deaths related to planes, trains and automobiles. We've had a head-on train crash in Switzerland, a high-speed derailment in Spain, a runaway train in Quebec, and what appears to be a French reenactment of Potter's Bar. There was a nose wheel collapse in New York, a runway undershoot in San Francisco, and a much less reported crash in Goma that killed 20 times as many people as the New York and San Francisco accidents put together. In the US alone over this time, the daily number of deaths in automobiles is bigger than any of those accidents. But that's not news. It's very tempting for the media to try to weave some narrative to tie all of these events together. I'm doing it myself by making the comparison between mass transit and automobiles. Really, though, there's no particular connection at all. Major accidents are slightly seasonal, but other than that, they're randomly distributed, so you'd expect to find an occasional clustering like this. Putting lots of accidents together at the same time, though, does make it easier to see patterns, and there's one theme that I've noticed that links all of these accidents together. The high level of media interest, and the immediacy of online reporting and blogging, lends itself to a lot of early speculation before all of the facts are available. This in turn is causing the return of that old habit of blaming the operator. Now, that's not new, but what shocks me is just how blatant the blame is. We've got respected journalists such as Simon Jenkins in The Guardian stating, without embarrassment or apparent reader outrage, that true blame attaches to those, quote, immediately responsible. And Jenkins makes very clear that when he says immediately responsible, he means the drivers, and if it can't be pinned on the drivers, then he means the maintainers. Consider this, though. It's a simple law of physical time that the very last mistake made before any accident will almost always be made by the driver or pilot. That's exactly the same temporal law in play if you drop your laptop out of a window to a friend on the ground. The very last mistake will be made by your friend failing to catch it. It doesn't mean, though, that there's any special significance or blame attached to that particular mistake, other than any other mistake in the sequence of events. In particular, your friend didn't set that chain of events in motion. A company called Baines Simmons have come up with a very useful way of analysing and explaining blame. They've called it Flowchart Analysis and Investigation Results, or FAIR, which has to be the most contrived acronym I've ever encountered, but it's a good system. The underlying idea is just because you might be one cause of an accident, that doesn't mean you should be blamed for it. At one end of the spectrum, we have deliberately trying to hurt someone else. If you actually meant to kill someone, then yes, you deserve to be blamed. Then we have situations where you are doing the wrong thing, and you knew that you were doing the wrong thing. If you're doing this for your own personal benefit, that's pretty bad. It's not as bad as deliberately trying to hurt someone, though. And what if it's not for your benefit, but for someone else's? Maybe for the good of the company? Maybe if you didn't do things that way, schedules wouldn't be met and jobs would be lost. It's still the wrong thing to do, but it's not as bad as doing it for your own gain. Then we have cases where you couldn't even do the right thing. The tools weren't available or the rules didn't fit in that particular situation. Even less blameworthy again is if you meant to do the right thing, you just made a bad decision. And then at the far extreme, we have cases where you actually did the right thing. You just made a simple mistake while doing it. That's not blameworthy at all. Unless you believe in original sin and that being human is an inherently fallen state to be in. The FAIR system includes a number of simple tests for safety investigators, which I think actually work pretty well when reading newspaper articles about accidents. Two of the tests are the substitution test and the routine test. The substitution test asks, would someone else in the same situation have done the same thing? Now, it's always very easy to be glib and say no, but actually think about it. Would someone else actually have behaved differently? And then the routine test asks, well, what actually happens? Does this happen often? Does it happen often within the organization, or does it happen often with the individual? For example, when you read a newspaper report that the Spanish train driver was on the phone to his company at the time of the accident, look for information to answer those tests. So either he called his company or they called him. At least one of them had to have a phone number to call the other. That can't have been a once-off thing. So were drivers often called by the company? Did drivers often call the company? And if this was happening all the time, then why place blame on this particular driver for this particular phone call? And if it wasn't happening all the time, then it must have been a rare event. Now, if you're a driver in a cabin and you never get a phone call from the company and suddenly you do, wouldn't anyone in that same situation wonder what was going on and pick up the phone? The bottom line here is that in real accidents, human error is never actually an explanation. It's just part of the accident description. It's a symptom. When the tail of the 777 at San Francisco hit a concrete wall, no one thought it was an explanation to say that the tail broke. That was just one event in the timeline caused by other events. And when we find out for sure what the pilots did or didn't do, that's not an explanation either. Those are events that are caused by other events. If you're in the habit of dropping laptops out of windows, how much right do you have to get mad when your friend makes the final mistake and eventually fails to make a catch? This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
For our last segment this week, we turned to Cash Farouk. It took a while for me to convince Cash to contribute to the show, but I finally managed to goad him into it. And he quickly found that after getting over the initial sort of psychological hurdle, it's fun too. Take this example from almost exactly 2 years ago. It was the week of the Nobel Prize announcements, and astonishingly, Cash managed to get an interview with the winner, Professor Brian Schmidt. We were as surprised as you when we heard this, so here's Cash talking physics with a Nobel-winning physicist.
Brian Schmidt of the Australian National University in Canberra was recently named as the joint winner of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. The formal citation reads, "For the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe through observations of distant supernovae." Brian and his team's work on the expansion of the universe fundamentally changed astrophysics. It opened up a whole new area of science and introduced the world to the concept of dark energy. Brian kindly agreed for me to call him to chat about the award and the science behind it. Thank you for speaking to the Pod Delusion Nobel laureate, Brian Schmidt.
My pleasure.
Firstly, let me congratulate on your award. It's well deserved.
Well, I hope so. Sometimes I have my doubts, but it has certainly been a great experience.
Yeah, I bet it has. Have things calmed down yet? Apart from random people like me asking if I can interview you, has anything else changed?
Well, it's still pretty busy, although it has calmed down. The first day was just completely insane, and now the requests are becoming longer and more complicated.
Right, okay. They want to go into more detail rather than just high level.
It's all sorts of stuff. You would, as I said, I'm on my way to Hawaii on Sunday, and the Queen is coming to Canberra next week, and I'm going to have to miss her. So things are get complicated.
Okay, so we'll let's start at the beginning. You moved to the U.S. From the U.S. to Australia in '94, and made the discovery in '98. Can you explain what your team were doing? You know, what projects you were setting up, what you discovered, how you went about discovering, you know, this acceleration?
Yeah. So I finished my PhD at Harvard in 1993, and I started a postdoctoral fellowship at the what they call the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. I was actually sort of a part of the Smithsonian side rather than the Harvard side, and I was looking for something to do. And in 1994, Mario Hamui from Chile came up and showed us his new data on supernovae, which showed that you could use them to measure distances very precisely. And at the same time, Saul Perlmutter, who had been trying to discover supernovae for about 6 years in 1994, suddenly found seven of them all at once. And so I was going down to observe in Chile in 1994, and so I had a chat with the group down there, and a man named Nick Sunseth, who is an astronomer down there, and I hatched the plan that we would take on Saul Perlmutter's team in measuring how fast the universe was slowing down over time. And this was just before I moved to Australia. I knew I was moving to Australia. And so I figured that although Saul's team had been working on this a long time, our team had been working on it from the other side, that is the supernova side. And so it seemed to me to be a reasonable thing to go out and try this experiment. And in the end, when I moved to Australia, it was really about trying to measure what the universe did back in time by looking at really, really distant objects. I really put my heart and soul in when I got here to Australia for really 3.5 years.
One of the interesting stories that neatly demonstrates how science can work is, you know, you were out there to show that it was slowing down, and you found the exact opposite, which opened up the whole new area of physics. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes. Yeah, so I always like to work on big questions. And so when I came to Australia, I figured I might as well try to answer a big question. The question I was looking to answer was, how fast does the universe slow down, and therefore gauge the future of the universe? If the universe slows down a little bit, then it'll just keep expanding forever. If the universe slows down a lot, then the universe will reach a maximum size, and then gravity will take over and run the universe in reverse. And just like a ball that you throw up in the air, it will crash down, and we'd get the Big Bang in reverse, which we like to call the Gnab-Gib. So that was the big question we were trying to answer. So after 3 years, I guess, the data were coming in, and I was talking to Adam Rees, who was, you know, spearheading this work. We sort of handed out each part of the project to young people. And so Adam was, you know, one of the few young people on the team. So he's doing a huge amount of work. And he was showing the data, and that data showed, geez, the universe wasn't slowing down at all. It was speeding up. And so that was a real crazy thing to be confronted with. It didn't make a lot of sense. It seemed just impossible. So it was a pretty scary time when we first saw that result.
How many times did you have to, you know, double check, triple check your results before you actually had the guts to make the announcement?
Well, we went through and, you know, initially you just start looking for problems and checking and rechecking everything. But after a while, you've sort of done everything you can, and nothing's obviously wrong. So, you know, we sort of opened it up to the team and said, okay, guys, we got this crazy result. Any test you want us to do, we'll test. We think we've tested them all at this point, but anything you want to do. And they have, you know, they the group came up with all sorts of things to think about. So we went through and worked more. But at some point, it slowly sunk in that the universal acceleration we were seeing just wasn't going to go away. So, you know, it took a few months, but we did everything we can several times, had several people do it, and everyone just got the same answer.
So when you made the announcement, just like the recent faster-than-light neutrinos announcement, what was the reaction around the world? Were scientists skeptical?
Well, I was expecting a reaction very similar to the faster-than-light neutrino announcement, where I think, you know, they've gone out, it's a good team, they've gone out and said, hey, we see this, and most of the world says, it's got to be wrong. In our case, I was expecting people to say, this is just wrong, and we'll figure out the problem. But some people were skeptical, and I don't blame them for being skeptical. I would have been skeptical as well. I was skeptical when we released it. I couldn't make the result go away. So the problem was, there were some problems in cosmology back in 1998 where things didn't quite work properly. the accelerating universe, if you used it to, you know, if you thought what made the universe accelerate, the only easy way to do it was to have the universe full of energy that had been previously unaccounted for. The stuff we call dark energy now, or what Einstein called the cosmological constant. Now, it turns out that this dark energy fixed most of the outstanding problems in cosmology. Now, it wasn't that this dark energy had been disproved particularly. It was just crazy that somehow we had missed 75% of the universe, and this 75% of the universe caused gravity to work in reverse. So it wasn't that, you know, that it had been disproved before, but it just seemed too crazy to believe. Yeah, so I think in case of the guys who are measuring the faster than speed of light neutrinos, you know, I commend them from coming out. I have to admit, I suspect there will be something found wrong, but I could be wrong. You know, maybe the universe really is crazy. And for some reason, these neutrinos, which are at very high energy, just travel faster than the other neutrinos we've been able to measure from supernovae, for example.
Where did the term dark energy come from? Was it just the obvious choice after dark matter term had already been, you know, already existed?
Well, it turns out the term dark energy, I believe, was invented right here in Canberra, Australia. And it was invented in the end of 1998 or early 99, I can't quite remember the date, by Mike Turner, a very well-known cosmologist, who we invited here to sort of give a cosmology talk right after the acceleration. We had a big conference here. And he invented the term for his talk called dark energy. And it's energy because, of course, it's tied to space. It's dark because we can't see it. And as people are beginning to get the hang of, when astronomers discover something they can't see, we just call it dark and then X, dark X. In this case, X was energy. You know, it really was a term that kind of sounded good and made sense. It fit in with dark matter, and it sort of describes what's going on. So I thought it was a great invention of Mike Turner's.
What does the acceleration mean for the distant future of the universe?
So right now, when light travels through the cosmos to us, it has to compete with the expansion of the universe to get to us. And, you know, the universe we see, the light takes a long time to get to us, but it gets to us. In the future, because the universe is speeding up, that is, it's expanding faster and faster over time, at some point, galaxies we can see now will be stretched. The universe will have stretched so much between us and those galaxies that the light will never reach us. If you take this to further and further in the future, it turns out that the entire universe, which is not gravitationally bound to us right now, will eventually be stretched beyond our ability to see it. So we will look out into a universe which you cannot do cosmology on because there's nothing to see. It will be a very empty universe. And the part of the universe that we're part of will all sort of collapse down into a giant super galaxy. And the stars in the super galaxy will slowly use their nuclear fuel and turn out into little stellar embers that just fade away into oblivion. And so it will be a very cold, lonely universe in the future.
Well, what does the award mean for Australian science? How has the media and the public reacted?
So, you know, it's been really positive here. I think Australia hasn't had a Nobel Prize winner in physics since 1950. The Braggs, so Bragg scattering, very important discovery. So it's been a long time between drinks. Australia spends a lot of effort on science, and we have a very good university system here. But I think the excitement of a Nobel Prize really has captured everyone. So I've got to meet with, you know, members of both parties, the prime minister, the finance minister. Everyone is just really excited. Even the what I would describe as the shock jocks on radio have been universally really excited about it. So it's really been incredibly positive. And I think it's caused the country, as best as I can tell, to reflect a bit on why science is important. And of course, that's what's really important to me. I want people to understand that the country's future prosperity really depends on educating people and getting a bunch of scientists to go up and be able to do things, invent new technology, and that's what the prosperity is going to be. So from my perspective, it's been universally positive.
Do you think the award will help in funding?
Well, so, you know, Australia is in the interesting situation right now of being quite a healthy economy. Our politicians like to say that we're in some dire situation, but the reality is we're in a very good situation right now. And so, while we could certainly do better on our funding, our research grant program here is underfunded a lot by international standards and even by British standards, which I know have taken a huge hit over the last few years. But there's a lot of things we do fund well. We fund our major infrastructure very well. Australia is very keen to bring the Square Kilometer Array to Australia. We think we have a superb place to do this next generation radio telescope, and so the government's spending lots of money on that. And on a giant new telescope that I'm part of in the optical regime called the Giant Magellan Telescope. So the funding situation here is a little hit and miss, but I think it's pretty good. But what I'm hoping I can bring is to emphasize the importance of continuity. So one problem we have here in Australia is that each government has a set of new ideas and the whole landscape changes with the changing government. And as a scientist who I'm working on 5 to 10 year horizon, that changing landscape makes it very, very hard to plan. And so I'm hoping I can get that, you know, we don't have to spend that much more money, but we just have to spend it really smartly. And if we do that, science in this country will flourish.
So how do you answer the typical question that, you know, you'll hear from a politician is, how will your research make money?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. We had a science awards dinner the night before last, where I got to give a speech, and the winners of the award ceremony for us, you know, Australian Scientist of the Year, was the person who invented the techniques with polymers that Australians use to make our money. And so as I pointed out to everyone, you know, gosh, I always trying to worry about how to make money with my discoveries. And this man truly took the most direct route for making money with his discovery. And so you never know how your discovery is going to work out. This guy really is, you know, has all of the scenery in Australia is based on his work. That being said, here in Australia, one of my colleagues, John O'Sullivan, who was a radio astronomer who, back in the 1970s, was looking for evaporating black holes. And he never, and these are predicted by Stephen Hawking, and he never found them. But what he did realize is that he was having to correct for the way radio waves travel many different directions to the Earth through space. And that's what he called multipath propagation. And he realized that was the same problem that they were having in doing radio high-speed communication. And so he and a group of other people here in Australia, and he's a radio astronomer, he invented Wi-Fi. So he was responsible for 802.11. And that has made Australia billions of dollars. It's worth, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars internationally. So there was a place where the basic research, astronomy, turned into, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of stuff. Research is funny. You don't go through and expect. If you just go through and invent what you know, then at some point you asymptotically approach no change. Basic research provides revolutions in how to do things. And, you know, society has emerged out of the dark ages because of that basic science and education transferring up into the knowledge chain that eventually gives us technology. And so I try to explain that chain to the government, and as near as I can tell, the government gets it. They really do. Not sure if they believe it, but I think they get it.
That's good news. So where do you go from here? What are you currently working on?
So I am in the final stages of putting a new telescope onto the sky called SkyMapper. And this is a telescope which is from Australia, going to survey every square inch of the southern sky to a level 10 million times fainter than you can see with your human eye, 36 times. And so this map of the sky will catalog billions upon billions of objects, And it's really useful to find the very rare objects in the sky that can help us decipher how things work. So, for example, it will be able to find if there are any Pluto-like objects that haven't been discovered in the southern sky. The southern sky hasn't been looked at very carefully. It will help us find the most distant objects in the universe. It will help us find stars that have been thrown out of the region around the central black hole of the Milky Way. It'll help us find stellar fossils left over from just after the Big Bang. And so it's going to produce sort of a treasure map that we can use the biggest telescopes that we have now and in the future to go through and do detailed studies. And so that is a huge project. It'll take more than a petabyte of data. So a petabyte of data is 1,000 terabytes, which of course is 1,000 gigabytes each terabyte. So it's a lot of data. It's a huge project, and it's just getting started right now.
It sounds very exciting. I'm going to have to ask you the question that I'm sure everyone has asked you. Did you think somebody was winding you up when you received the phone call?
I was suspicious that I have a couple of mischievous graduate students, and it occurred to me that just possibly I was a practical joke, but I was incredibly impressed with how good they got the Swedish accent. But after a couple seconds, it became pretty clear to me this was more than just a prank.
Okay, final question. Astrophysics is not your only passion. You're also a winemaker. And judging by the We Have Sold Out message on your website, winning a Nobel Prize is good for wine sales.
Yeah, so I decided when I moved out to the farm that I live at now that one of the things I could do in Australia that I couldn't do anywhere else was do something crazy like run a vineyard. And so on our farm, we have a 1.1 hectare Pinot Noir vineyard, which I work at, and it's my therapy, so make sure astronomy doesn't take over my life. And so things were slow at first. I've been, crafting, working on my trade of making wine. But yeah, about a year ago, I started getting it pretty right and have been selling out. And so I was down to 4 cases of wine when the Nobel Prize announcement went. And those 4 cases of wine went in literally 60 seconds after the announcement. So we'll see. It's certainly a great marketing tool, which I've been recommending to all my fellow winemakers here in Canada.
Which is easier, astrophysics or winemaking?
Well, they're very different and they're similar. The thing about astrophysics is I try to do astrophysics, the pieces of it, perfectly. I don't like making mistakes. And winemaking is all about making mistakes. And so where I expect to be pretty much close to perfect all the time in my astronomy, my winemaking, I know I'll never be perfect. And so in some sense, I think, you can never achieve a perfection in winemaking. Therefore, it's the harder thing to do. But it requires a slightly different set of skills.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. Brian, thank you very, very much indeed, and congratulations again.
My pleasure.
This has been Kash Farouk talking to the newly minted Nobel laureate, Brian Schmidt, for the Pod Delusion.
And that's just about it for this week's special show. If you've been inspired, if you'd like to help the Pod Delusion, if you'd like to contribute, if you'd like to record segments for us and get involved and that sort of thing, you can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. If you can't think of anything particularly you'd like to do, why not join our mailing list and see if that inspires you? Just drop me a line to sign up at poddelusion.co.uk. Also on our website, you can listen back to 4 years' worth of podcast archives, follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, which are all nice things to do as well. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Sean Ellis, Liz Luckendorf, Drew Ray, Sandra Prow, Kash Farouk, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.